Hey, AM writers, it's Jess, your favorite geek here, still learning from the Great Courses Plus. Last week, I talked to you a little bit about Boudica. This week, I am learning about Perpetua. She was martyred in the arena. She was a Christian martyr. And if you would like to learn about, you know, maybe even something more uplifting than that, you could go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting and you can get a whole month free. It's pretty cool. You can try it out, learn a whole bunch of cool stuff. Whatever it is you want to learn, anything from botany to astronomy to, you know, women in history, very cool women in history. Again, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay.
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone trying to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is #AmWriting, the podcast about writing all the things. Short things, long things, fictional things, non-fictional things, things that fall somewhere in between, although you better know what that label is. In short, this is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming The Addiction, Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence, coming out on April 6th.
Getting close. I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, as well as the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, and former editor and lead writer of the Motherload blog at the New York Times. And we have a guest today.
Such a guest. We have Ron Lieber with us. Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist at the New York Times. He's written lots of other places as well, stuff that we'll get into because essentially there was some really cool stuff about where he's worked in the past that's in the book that we want to talk about today. And he has a new book coming out by the time this comes out, I think. Yes, KJ?
Oh, yeah.
Called The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. Ron Lieber, welcome to the podcast.
I am so glad to finally be here.
We have so much to talk about. Also, it should be disclosed that we have known you for a while. This is not... This is you are a friend as well as a colleague and a writing hero of mine. By the way, when I finished this book, I was like, I knew it was going to be good. I was just really amazed by the amount of data that's in this book because, as you know, that whole, and as KJ knows, the whole idea of writing about data is so tricky because you can't bore your readers to death. You have to make it sort of go somewhere from a narrative perspective. And so I want to start right off with the question of sort of where this book came from and how you arrived at that sort of balance between data and story.
Sure. So to quote a great personal finance sage, Tim Maurer, personal finance is more personal than it is finance. This book is personal. It's personal for three reasons. When I was in high school, my family had fallen on some, you know, relatively complicated times financially, and we were not going to be able to afford to pay for the schools that I wanted to attend. I was on scholarship at a private school in Chicago, and we had to sort of figure out how the financial aid system worked. And the people at my school didn't really know that much about it because it was a lot of pretty affluent families there. And so they sent us to this guy up in Evanston, Illinois, who was able to help us sort it out. We just had to pay him $50, and he sort of explained how the secrets of the financial aid system work. And so I learned very early on that there were always grown-ups out there who knew how to, like, crack the code on any given system if you could just find them. That experience stayed with me, right? How much that guy changed my life by helping us be able to afford college. So flash forward a bunch of years, and all of a sudden, maybe not surprisingly, I've become a personal finance columnist. I had a kid 15 years ago, then we had another kid 10 years after that. And I wanted to understand, right? Like, how are we supposed to save for college? And I started writing about that. Started writing about how we were supposed to pay for college. Lots of student loan stories, right? But then a couple of years ago, readers started coming to me and being like, wait. the most expensive schools in the country are now $300,000. That's insane. Even my flagship state university is $100,000 for 4 years. Also insane. And there's a six-figure difference between those two numbers. Totally insane, right? So where is the big data set that explains to me why a $300,000 college is $200,000 better than the $100,000 college? I did not know. Felt like a new idea to me. And so, you know, for those readers too, it was personal. And once I reframed the question for myself, the fact that what I really should have been writing about all along was what to pay for college, that felt like a new personal finance question, a new parenting question, and a question that it was going to take years to answer and couldn't be done in a newspaper column.
And by the time you get there, by the time you get to the point where your kids, you're like starting to talk about colleges, you're start, first of all, if you haven't started the saving like way before that, I believe early on in the book, you talk about the fact that, you know, if you're going to go to a really expensive college, you need to start, like if you start the moment the baby drops out of the uterus, you're talking $1,000 a month that you've got to start, you know, sticking somewhere. And that's if you only have one kid. So by the time you get to that decision, it is such an overwhelming proposition between FAFSA and between, you know, the applying part, that adding the money on top of such a stressful decision about how far away your kid is going to go and where they'll live and all that sort of stuff, it feels really, really overwhelming. And the cool thing about your book is that you broke it down in a way that makes a lot of sense and is approachable. And so, you know, you talk about this thing being personal. So what do you do with this avalanche of data that you've unearthed and put that together? Since, you know, I want to definitely talk about your book, but our listeners are mainly writers. They want to know about the research. They want to know about the structure. They want to know about the process and how all of that comes together for you.
So I had a hunch very early on that there were going to be a lot of things that I wanted to say, right? I wanted to explain to people who pays what and why and how the systems of financial aid and discounting actually work. Right. I knew I wanted the book to be emotionally intelligent, and I wanted it to help people be emotionally honest. So I wanted to identify the feelings that get in the way of really good decision making. I wanted to write about all of the things that somebody might be tempted to pay a whole lot extra for when it comes to college. I wanted to write about tips and tricks and hacks and money saving things. And I wanted to download all of the personal finance stuff I'd stuffed into my brain over 15 years. And so I realized, right, people were going to run away in horror if I did not make it bite-sized. So I knew at the beginning that there had to be a lot of chapters. They were going to be really short. And if you had a kid who was 4, or you had a kid who was 14, or you had a kid who was 18, there would be something, maybe many things, maybe the whole thing in there for you. But if you didn't want it all, that would be fine. It was going to be kind of eminently skip-aroundable. And so when you do that, right, if no chapter is longer than an average of like 9 or 10 pages, people will, I hope they will stick with you. They will stay with you if you insert, you know, maybe a page or two of data in a short chapter that they know that they can get through relatively quickly. So that was the big idea.
This thing, the thing that really struck me was the biggest questions I had were questions that I thought were kind of fringe questions, like what extra fancy things or new ideas actually make it worth the extra cost. Like, I remember when we were touring colleges, I said to my kid, when we were done with each tour, what did you like and what you didn't you like? And you're not allowed to say the dorm rooms were fancy or, you know, that kind of thing. Like, what essential thing really makes you like a place and not like a place? And what makes it worth the money and what makes it not worth the money? So when I opened up your book and I looked at the table of contents, I said, oh, these are the actual questions that we were talking about that don't tend to be the big questions about how do you fill out a FAFSA? So for those of you out there just listening and, of course, can't see what's happening, Ron's doing a happy dance in his office that he actually addressed the questions that I think people who are actually sending kids off to college are asking.
So, Jess, I'm going to call you out on something really interesting that you probably didn't notice.
Oh, no.
You use the word fancy.
Yeah.
You are not the only one who uses the word fancy to describe colleges. I actually, in the early part of the reporting process, found myself using it as an adjective, not just to describe amenities, but to describe schools. And mm-hmm. I talked myself out of it because I didn't feel like it was properly descriptive. But then at the very end, I came back to it again because I've got a kind of sporadic relationship with Town and Country magazine, which, yeah, you laugh. But for those of you who haven't looked at it in a couple of years, they've totally redesigned the thing and they have a very arched eyebrow about the 1%. It sort of, you know, fits my vibe surprisingly well. And so I went to them 6 months ago and I said, can I do a piece about fancy? And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, look, you are the magazine of luxury products and luxury brands. And I think something really interesting is going on with higher education here, where there are a number of established luxury brands as far as higher education goes. But then there are a couple of like scrappy colleges trying to fight their way up. They have created luxury products that are not yet luxury brands. And so I did a 3,000 word piece for Town and Country talking about how colleges become luxury products and when, if ever, they can transform themselves into luxury brands.
Well, it's fun. Well, when I use the word fancy, I'm thinking A, Lazy River, which plays an interesting role in your book. I'm thinking about things that are not central to the central objective of learning and becoming a human. I don't know. The Lazy River is the obvious example, but you know, there are a lot of things that colleges are adding on in order to compete that I think of as fancy. And when I say fancy, you know, clearly I went to a state school with some grimy carpets and, you know, one bathroom per floor that, you know, where the toilets worked about half the time.
Cinder block so, walls.
Yeah. Fancy for me is a very broad category.
Well, but so that's it, right? Right. So we're as parents, as purchasers of this service, we're anchoring our perspective in the cinder block walls that may have surrounded us 25 or 30 years ago. But what the schools are anchoring themselves in is the manner in which these children have become accustomed, right? They are only seeking to match whatever it is you've got cooking there in Vermont, or create a lazy river that's, you know, actually a minor league version of the one that you might have seen at, like, not the Four Seasons, but, you know, just like a middlebrow resort in Orlando, right? So they don't see it as fancy. They just see it as, you know, appealing to a certain segment of mass affluent Americans who have festooned their residences and their vacation locations with some of the same stuff that are now on campuses.
All right. So I'm going to ask you a question similar to the question we asked Jeff Salingo when he came on to talk about his book about college and getting into college, which is, how do you get people who have a vested interest in spin to tell you the truth about finance, their college, how their process works, where the money goes? You know, there are a lot of people who can get into some PR trouble when they tell you the truth. So how do you get there?
Well, one of the things I tried to do was find people who work in these colleges, who have tenure, who themselves are experts on higher education, who have children, who have shopped for the experience themselves in recent years, and ask them how they did it. Now, this is not foolproof, because at some of the more well-endowed institutions, some of the more selective institutions, they have these sort of swapping arrangements where, you know, if you work at one place, your kid can go to this other place in the consortium for half off. And so they're not playing in the market quite the way that we are. But, you know, when you have tenure, you can say stuff. You know, I felt it useful to talk to the people with tenure. But, you know, the other thing I tried to do was just be myself, you know. In my day job, I am in the business of asking uncomfortable questions. And I didn't see any reason why I should you know, shy away from that in my role as an author. And, you know, sometimes people, you know, sort of clammed up, but more often than not, people were willing to talk. And I think what's changed is that, you know, they sort of smelled something on me, right? They smelled that I was like the self-appointed representative of all of these people who earn just enough money so that they probably won't qualify for a ton of financial aid, but not so much that they could just go run around, you know, writing $75,000 checks. They might not even be able to run around writing $25,000 checks for the state university. And they know that they have a problem. They know that this is hard. They know that people have spent a ton of money in the first 18 years just trying to get these kids good enough, right? Qualified enough, ready to attend these institutions. And so they get it. So, you know, they were willing to dish.
Mm-hmm. Okay, total departure from this topic for 1 second, but as someone who does a lot of research and has to wade through a lot of data, this is a question we ask people who write nonfiction a lot, and a question I get a lot. How do you know when it's time to put down the research and start writing? How do you know when you're there? Where does that moment happen for you? Whether that's for a 1,200-word piece on, you know, finance or a book like this, because for many of us, I mean, I think it helps for you that you are an expert in the finance topic to begin with. But I know for myself, when I'm trying to become an expert in a topic, it can be very tempting to wait around in the research for a little bit longer than is useful.
Sure. So, you know, I'm glad you think I'm an expert. I'm just looking up at the list of chapter titles here, and I feel like I had part five.
Wait, I have to stop you. Do you have them posted up on the wall somewhere?
I do. I've got a, you know, piece of butcher paper, and there's index cards. And I you know, the whole time during my reporting, I walked around with these index cards in my backpack all the time. And I would take them out from time to time and be like, I don't know. Is this going to work, right? Or should it be in a different order? And then eventually they went up on the wall when I started on the first draft. So yeah, they're still there, even though the book is about to come out, because it's a useful reference point, especially when you have 35 chapters, right? So I'm just looking here, and you know, I pretty much had part five nailed even before the reporting started. I knew a lot of what I needed to know for part one. I was like completely ignorant about part two, mostly ignorant about part three, and partly ignorant about part four. And so I was by no means an expert when I started. There was a lot of stuff that I needed to learn. And look, I mean, in this way, I mean, I'll just level with you, right? The deadline is your friend. You know, I have this day job, which I love, and I got a very generous book leave, but it was not going to be enough to just like meander through decades of research about how college students learn and under what circumstances they don't. And so
can I stop you for 1 second? Because I think our listeners would love to know sort of what a book leave looks like for someone who works at the New York Times. What is this a standard amount of time?
So standard time is 6 months, unpaid. And I'm trying to remember now. My head is such a fog. I'm pretty sure it gets a little complicated in our household because my wife and I both work at the New York Times, but she's in the union. I am not. We both took book leaves in the last 4 years, and I took multiple ones. So the whole like logistics of what insurance were we on and when, and did we pay for it out of pocket and like whatever. We were able to string it together. And look, we're extraordinarily fortunate that they hold our jobs open and let us go in this way. I have nothing to complain about. And because I negotiated my leave under a like previous administration, you know, a large handful of years ago, I was able to take some extra time. But you know, as you know, 6 months is not enough for a book. 16 months is not enough time for a nonfiction book. And
okay, so let me take you back to where you were, which is when you said your deadline is your friend and you have this amount of time. So how do you know when it's time to move from the research into the writing?
Well, so the deadline is your friend. And like, if you're getting towards the deadline, you just got to go, right? And so I was sort of used to this, right? This felt a little bit to me like writing 35 long columns. And if I have to, and often I do, you know, I can get a pretty good column churned out in 4 days flat, right? Now, I spent more than 4 days on all of these chapters, but if you do it right, and if you can get people to pick up your calls, right? Speaking of privilege, right? It's like, big chief New York Times here. People pick up the phone more often than not. And that's a, it's a much harder thing for other people to do in certain circumstances. But you should certainly try, right? And so what I tried to do is, quickly identify the 5 to 10 smartest people in America on the question of, all right, so is my kid like really going to get an athletic scholarship or not? And if they're not, like how much is it going to help them get into a Division III school that they might not get into otherwise? And then I just, kind of strip mine those people's brains to the extent that they would spend time with me.
I love that.
And wrote down everything that they said and tried to form it into a, coherent, 2,000 word whole. And then more than anything, right? And this may sound like a cop out, but really it's, I think it's a tactic, right? As much as I wanted to produce some kind of all encompassing algorithm that would tell people exactly what to pay for college, I kind of knew at the beginning that that was not going to be realistic. And so the best thing I can do for people is to make them like 15 times smarter about the process than they were before. And one of the ways to do that is to help them think of questions that they might never imagine asking themselves, and then arm them with that list where they can pick and choose those questions in all of these categories to then go out into the world and make themselves smarter than me. Right? If you have a kid who has struggled with mental health diagnoses, right? Yeah. So there's a whole chapter about that. This is like epidemic.
Well, and I'm holding the book open to that chapter right now because A, I'm so grateful you wrote this chapter. And B, it wouldn't occur to most people to look at whether or not their school has mental health services as part of the value of the school. But what people are seeing right now during this pandemic is that this is an incredibly important part of the puzzle. And it never would have occurred to me to consider that to be something I should think about, look for, in my search.
Right. So, this is what reporters do, right? So it's like, so there's my thought process. For example, my thought process there, right, is like, okay, has anybody ever written a book about this? Well, turns out somebody had written a really good book about it right as I started doing the work on this. Okay, who do I know who's a reporter in this area and is really smart on mental health? Found that person. Who do I know who actually works in this field, who's like a friend or a friend of a friend, who can give me the off the record dish? Did that, right? And then the next thing I did is like, I thought, okay, well, there's got to be a national association of people who sit in offices on campuses and talk to undergrads about their feelings, right? So I'm going to go find that. So I went and got that. And, they do this like annual data set and survey. And I'm reading through and it's just this cornucopia of data about the number of days or sometimes weeks that people need to wait for their first appointment. And then I got to the most insane thing where there were all these questions about shedding, S-H-E-D-D-I-N-G, shedding, as in like shedding your skin. And I'm like, what are you people talking about? This is the term of art that at least some of them use for offloading patients so that you can bring in new ones. Yeah, goodbye, right? Gotta close this one down. Don't really have the capacity to do this. It's not our
core
competency.
In hospitals, it's called turfing.
Yeah. And I thought, wow, I really do not want my kid to be shed. And how am I going to find the place where they are not going to shed my kid if she needs help?
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about, the reason I had my finger open to that chapter, and you mentioned that your chapters are like 2,000 words, okay? So you and I have the same editor. You and I were writing our books similar. They overlapped. My chapters are between 9 and 10,000 words each, like 9,000 words each. Yeah. So something that occurred to me this morning, and it just turned out that way. It wasn't my intention. That's just how my chapters turned out. And it occurred to me this morning while I was on the telephone with my publicist, while we're talking about where we're going to put excerpts and where we're going to put, blah, 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 that you have created a magnificent creation for figuring, for putting some pieces, excerpts, places, because you have written magazine or newspaper length chapters, and I have written behemoths that I am going to have to slice and dice in various ways in order to make them work.
Yeah, so it did occur to me early in the process that was a potential benefit of the way I was doing it. Now, as you know, right, I think harder about publicity and marketing on the front end than, you know, nearly anybody. I try to be like super strategic about it, but really that was not the reason I wrote the book that way, but it has absolutely proven to be a benefit. Like there's a publication called Next Avenue that just, you know, stripped out some grandparent stuff that like wasn't even its own chapter. I thought about doing a grandparent chapter. I probably should have actually. But he just like went and found the grandparent stuff and like grabbed it and put it into a coherent whole. And now it's going up on this website where a lot of grandparents read, you know, about their personal finances. And that's great. So yes, right? If you, there's nothing wrong with you if you begin the researching and writing process with the idea of making it not just easily digestible for the reader, mm-hmm. but easily promotable, right? Because like, you know, what good are you if nobody's going to read the book, and nobody's going to read the book unless you can promote it, and you're not going to be able to promote it unless you have bite-sized things to pass out to people.
Well, and I have to say, you know, on the other end, I think about marketing and promotion years in advance of when a book is going to come out, and it completely eluded my. I mean, I always think about things like as I'm going along, like, oh, that's an interesting short line that would fit in a tweet that, you know. And I was just reading the audiobook last week, and I took some Post-its with me and stuck them in and stuff like that.
Smart. Stop. Say that again slowly. I know I'm not in charge here, but that is an incredible tip. I totally didn't think to do that this time or the last
time. It's hardly doable, though, if you think about the way reading an audiobook works is, A, you have to remain completely silent and not move from that spot, right, that your producer has said is perfect right in front of the microphone. So I had to reach over very carefully to the copy that I brought with me to stick the Post-it note in without moving my face too far away from the microphone, because my producer would get miffed when I moved too much. So I had to be
very careful. So, that makes me think of something else that I thought of this morning when I was bathing, which is that one thing that would be really useful at the end of all of these processes, if we all had valets, right? Because like in the 3 minutes that it took to bathe, there were five things that I remembered or that I thought of for the first time. And I didn't have anything to do with, I didn't have any place to put the five things.
Hold on. You are the person, though, that KJ and I refer to all the time. Don't you have a waterproof thing you can write on in your shower?
Yes. But when we fixed up the bathroom, all the waterproof crayons disappeared from the last book, and that was another thought I had this morning. But the other thought, but
listener, let me back up for a second. He has waterproof crayons that he uses in the shower to write down ideas. I'm sorry, Serena Bowen, are you listening to this? Waterproof crayons in the shower to write things on the walls.
I got to get some more crayons on the way home. But what I really want is a valet who can just like deal with the stuff. And if you had a valet, you could have just like waved your arm in the air, and the valet would have known that that was the signal to highlight
that
passage, and you could start like preloading them into buffer right now, and you wouldn't be panicking the way that I am at this moment 4 days before pub that you like don't have your shit together.
Yeah, that would have been nice except because of the pandemic, I was in a studio in someone's house that had blankets strung around everything, and there was no seeing into the booth. So yeah, I would have had to have like a very small person stuffed into the corner or something like that. So yeah.
Babe, you gotta suffer to be a valet.
You really do. You really do. I mean, some people are, you know, willing to do that to get stuffed into a room for 4 days so that they can write down my notes. KJ, I'm sorry, you haven't had a word in edgewise. Is there anything you would like to add to this conversation? We're having so much fun.
You are, and I knew that you would, and I am, you know, longer out of the nonfiction world than either of you?
Come back.
It occurred to me.
I don't think so.
I don't blame you.
It occurred to me that we often give the advice that if people are looking to, you know, often people say, how do you choose your agent or how do you choose an editor? And we often say, go look at books of people that you really admire and look in the acknowledgement section. By the way, your acknowledgement section was just so detailed and amazing. People could very easily figure out who Ron it relies on in his writing and look to see who the editor or agent is. But if someone looked at your book and my book, they would never guess that they both have the same editor, because Gail Winston, maybe she's brilliant. She's amazing. She has shaped me as a book writer, but our books are structured so differently, and your chapters are short and my chapters are long. And it's really amazing to me that someone like Gail can look at both of these things and say, these two very different structures work for these two very different books. That was just amazing to me as I was reading it, that our editor helped birth these two very different creatures. I like it.
Yeah, you know, she has eclectic tastes, and I think she has eclectic tastes for structure too. She didn't mm-hmm. really comment too much about the structure. I had a pretty good sense of it, you know, going in, and she didn't disagree, I guess. You know, the thing that I appreciate about her more than anything, and maybe you feel differently, but I appreciate her ear. And it was important to me, particularly with the last book, that I got the tone right. That book was all about how and when and why to talk to kids about money and what to say when you do. And, you know, I didn't want to sound like a person who was rich, and I didn't want to sound like someone who hated rich people. I just wanted to sound like your friend. And the thing that I'd heard about Gail before I signed on with her was that she was just really good at tone, right? And it proved to be true with this book, too.
I think it's worth pointing out that Gail also edits Renee Denfeld, who is a fiction writer who has almost a magical realism thing going on. And so Gail's tolerance for all different kinds of language and the way they're used, I think, is really amazing. And she was my dream editor. When my first book went to auction, Gail was who I was hoping would end up on top. And I think if she hadn't ended up on top of the auction, I probably still would have chosen her, because I was just so impressed with her. So it's been a fantastic partnership. And it's clearly been great for you two as well, because your books have been, I love the structures of both of your books. And oh, the other book we're talking about of Ron's is The Opposite of Spoiled, and it's about raising kids to be able to understand and deal with money in a way that is about character and is about open communication. It's a fantastic book, a wonderful, wonderful book.
Can we back up for a sec just to to your proposal? How it sounds like it was pretty close. Whatever you wrote as a proposal, it sounds like your structure was pretty close to what you actually ended up with, which I would imagine made things a little easier. Did you know what categories you were going to be? Did you know your 35 chapters going in, or did they multiply?
I knew that there were going to be a lot relatively, you know, there were going to be a relatively large number, and that they were going to be short. That was a goal. I didn't know how long it was going to go. But the structure took place pretty early, and it didn't really change all that much. I mean, chapters came in and out, you know, subjects came in and out, but the structure didn't really change, all that much. I'm sure there were like months of struggle in there, and there were years of struggle just to figure out what this was. Like I knew for a while I had a college book in me, but the framing took me a couple years to sort out. But then once I had the framing, the structure then became more clear.
How did you work with that, knowing, okay, you know, here I am in my day job, but I'm trying to come up with my next book project, and I think it's probably going to be like this. Did you set aside time when you would actually think about it? Did you just think about it on the subway? Would you, you know, did you have a file? What was the process of keeping track?
So there were a couple things going on. I mean, when I started The Opposite of Spoiled, when I started the reporting for it in like 2012 or something, you know, it became clear very quickly that that book needed to stop at age 16 for the kids, because the college thing, it was just such a big number. It was looming so large. It was like its own thing, right? But then, you know, everywhere in that research, there's just so much adjacent college stuff. And I just kept running into it. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. This is interesting. And then I was like, huh, something's here. I don't know what it is, right? So like every college thing just got chucked into a single Google Doc that just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And the way I finally cracked the code was just through my day job, right? So, you know, I write about anything and everything that hits you in the wallet, with a specialty in stuff that costs a lot of money and evokes or invokes or both a lot of feelings, and where there's a lot of like opacity and, you know, confusion. And so college is like, you know, the perfect like center of that Venn diagram. And I'd become somewhat obsessed with it personally. So I was writing about it probably as much as I was writing about any topic. So, you know, I don't know, 6 or 8 columns a year out of, you know, 40 or 50. And so I just kind of wrote my way into the thing, right? I just kept, you know, biting off questions that confused me or confusing people who were going through the process. And, you know, for better or for worse, with an eye towards and a mind on, you know, the upper middle class defined loosely, right? You know, the average New York Times subscriber who pays for my work. You know, eventually it just sort of worked itself out. There was not a like moment of revelation when it was clear that like, oh, you dummy, like you spent all this time writing about saving for college and paying for college, and you never realized that like what people were really wigging out about was what to pay for college. There was not, I don't think, like a moment of truth, but eventually I worked that language out in my head and I just kept saying it to myself. And I was like, oh yeah, that's it, right? This book is called What to Pay for College. And it was called What to Pay for College for a pretty long time. But then we changed it.
One of the things I have to say that your short chapters have me thinking, because I've been working on the proposal for book 3, and I wrote a little blog post this past weekend about the fact that I had shoehorned myself into a very specific idea of what I thought my table of contents was going to look like for this proposal. And I tend to think in terms of these big long chapters, but now my brain is kind of churning on what if I did these shorter things. And I think that would also help me with the whole, sometimes I lose track of where I am when a chapter gets as long as 8,000 to 9,000 words. You know, it's a big sort of, but you know, if your comfort zone tends to be, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 words, it would be really lovely to write shorter chapters. So that's now cooking in my brain there, Ron.
I would cook it further. I have to say that's so much easier than last time. I mean, again, much depends on where you're coming from, right? You know, I write very short chapters for a living. And so the sort of cadence of that, or whatever, for lack of a better word, is pretty much imprinted on my brain at this point. You know,
I think it also helps with the getting in and getting out of your chapter. Like for me, there's a certain hump of, oh my gosh, where am I in this behemoth and how do I get my brain back into it? I know with KJ and fiction, it must be a similar thing where...
Interestingly, I have really long chapters in my first book and I'm trying for shorter chapters. Well, it was partly because that was a dual point of view, shifting back and forth. So I couldn't really switch the chapter until I was ready to move the perspective. And this time, I'm looking, like, I think the last one's got 20-some chapters. This time I'm looking at, like, 40, but they're much shorter.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay.
That's it. That's the trend, like everyone. It. You heard it here first. The
yes,
trend
exactly.
Shorter chapters.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, another way to think about it, right? I mean, because book publishing, we have no user research, and we know nothing about customer satisfaction, because the publishers aren't really doing the research, right? But, you know, to my mind, right, it's like, we work for readers at the end of the day, right? And, you know, focus group of one here. It's not so much that I have a short attention span. It's just that I don't have a lot of time, right? And so I appreciate it when nonfiction and fiction, you know, comes to me in like relatively short bursts, because my life is just kind of like filled with short bursts. And, you know, I wish that wasn't the case. I've got who knows how many books here, right, with long chapters. And, like, I can't wait to pull them out, you know, in 10 or 15 years. But that's just not my life right now.
So in 10 or 15 years, we'll check in with you to see how your reading's been going.
But right now, why don't we take a quick break for a sponsor, and then we will talk about how your reading is going right now.
Mm-hmm.
Hey writers, KJ here, telling you, as I do every week, that this episode is proudly sponsored by Author Accelerator. I know many of you have tried the two-tier outline, explored a class, or even signed up to work with a coach, and we would love to hear how it's going. Head on over to our Facebook group to give us an update and let us know what you think. And now, on with the show.
All right. So this is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been reading, and we like to start with our guest. But I want to ask you a couple of quick new questions I've come up with first, Ron. So fiction or nonfiction?
Nonfiction.
Almost always?
Almost always. It's not because I dislike fiction. Again, it's time, and it's like need. There's a certain amount of nonfiction that I need to ingest for the day job, and then there's a whole bunch that I want to ingest to support the other nonfiction writers in my community who have been so great to me, you know, and I want to do them the same favor by sort of ingesting their work too. And so it's just time. It's not love, right? I desperately mix fiction, and I am so jealous of, you know, my wife who has a little more time right now, and my daughter in ninth grade who seems to have, you know, endless appetite for fiction all of a sudden after a couple of years of not really reading much fiction.
Nice.
And I so want to be that person again.
How many books do you usually have going at once?
One.
Wow.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
If that.
Crazy.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, let Jess and I wrap our head around that. So what have you read lately that you have liked?
You know, it's been a long couple of months, so I will confess to not having read a single book for pleasure in a couple months, at least.
Wow.
So, I mean, let me just give you a sense of like what it's like. I mean, we all have our own version of this to a certain extent, but my pandemic existence has like, you know, gone to like 2 to 3 times the level of busy from pre-pandemic, because the personal finance stuff at the day job has just, you know, sort of been insane, obviously. My book was delayed and I had to effectively retool parts of it and refact check the entire thing. You know, we've got a 15-year-old and a 5-year-old, different schools, schooling up for grabs. I've got a severe aging parent issue and all the attendant caregiving stuff that goes with that. And then I've participated in a lot of the vaccine coverage the last couple of weeks. And, you know, so if I want to exercise, and if I want to cook meals, and if I want to see my children, something has to go. And just at a very basic level, if I am not ingesting the entire New York Times, the entire Wall Street Journal, and, you know, a whole bunch of trade publications and newsletters, I can't do my job as effectively as readers expect. And so they're just like right now in my life, there's just not a ton of room for pleasure reading. So that is the sort of, you know, unfortunate fact. So I'm just looking over at my stack to see the things that I did read for work that I loved. I loved Unacceptable by Melissa Korn and Jennifer Levitz.
Loved
in the college
it.
Category.
Loved
just
it.
A rip-roaring narrative of that insane singer scandal with all of the, you know, grubby one percenters who cheated their way into school.
It was gripping.
Yep.
I couldn't put it down.
Like
I loved
a movie.
It.
I hope the movie happens.
Yeah.
You know, Jeff Salingo's book, you know, you had on about being sort of the fly on the wall in the admissions office. That was a much needed book and, you know, source of just intense curiosity for me. I really loved Morgan Housel's book on the psychology of money, which came out 6 months ago. There's not a ton of room for, you know, groundbreaking personal finance stuff, but he is maybe the most lucid writer on money alive. I don't think that's an exaggeration. And, you know, I'm jealous of his craft. And it was just a pure pleasure to read what he wrote.
Those sound like great recommendations.
Yes.
Jess, done anything fun lately?
So, yeah, I've had to do something weird. I'm into topics for the new book that I'm not talking about yet. And immersing myself in sort of the substance abuse thing because I'm doing a lot, I'm banking a lot of interviews for release. So I have to stay with one part of my brain in the substance abuse thing. But the fascinating book I read recently that I had not read when it came out is Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them by Joshua Green. Because, you know, obvious reasons, I think, you know, moral tribes and the gap between us and them is a big deal right now. It's something a lot of people have been thinking about. And I had read an article about Joshua Green's work and got intrigued and got the book, and I am loving this book.
It's really good.
So good.
I think I talked to him right after the last election for a piece, I'm pretty sure.
And yeah, he's smart and interesting, and he brings things together in a really cool way. And you know me, I love it when there's ideas coming from lots of different disciplines all sort of coalescing into ideas. I love that sort of thing. What are you reading?
Well, I note that I have read almost all fiction this month. Yay for me. That would be in January. But I guess I'm doing nonfiction February because I've just read Ron's book, which we already said we really liked. And I also actually, this is a reread, but it's so fascinating, it's worth the reread. I reread The Bestseller Code, which is a book about how computers can analyze best-selling books, by which they mean like massively best-selling, like Danielle Steele and who's the other? John Grisham. Those are the ones they really spend a lot of time on. And what kinds of things the computer sees as different about them. It's not like it's going to teach you how to write a bestseller. It's just fascinating you know, they have a whole section on why 50 Shades of Grey, generally books about sex don't sell, apparently. But 50 Shades of Grey, obviously the exception. So then they have a whole section about, you know, well, the computer didn't see it as about sex. The computer saw it as about a relationship that went up and down. It's fascinating. So I highly recommend that one. I've read it before. I'll probably read it again.
That's cool. That is very cool. I didn't even know about that book, and I'm definitely going to check that one out.
It is so good. All right.
All right. This has been, as I anticipated it would be, fascinating. And of course, at some point, we'll have to pick your brain more about just sort of, you know, there's so much to talk about the process. But I'm going out and getting waterproof crayons, I think. Thank you, Ron, so much for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
It was as much fun as I hoped it would be.
Oh, good. All right, everyone. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work. Pause. Stop. Stop. Thank you.